Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Given the way the Greek debt crisis has gone so far, it's probably too much to call any one event a turning point. But the vote tonight in the Greek parliament sure comes close. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the knowledge effect. And by Allianz, insuring more than 80 million customers worldwide and providing retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Happy Friday, gang. It's the 4th of November. Good to have you here. Greek lawmakers took their time tonight, but vote they did. Prime Minister George Papandreou won his vote of confidence after a debate on the bailout package that is meant to save the euro, the theory goes. Won by the hair on his chinny chin chin, though, 153 to 145. So our senior editor, Patty Hirsch, joins me now to explain what happens next. Hey, Patty.
Hello, Kai.
So we're done. Euro saved. The vote of confidence passed, and we can all go home now. Right?
Maybe. Depends on the numbers. The bailout package has to be supported by a parliamentary supermajority of 180 votes. And as you said, only 153 representatives voted for Papandreou in the session tonight. So he or his party now have to build a coalition government. And if they don't, Greece isn't going to get the first installment of its bailout money, which means Greece will go bankrupt.
Talk to me about that coalition. What are the odds, do you suppose, that it does actually wind up happening?
Well, it looks pretty difficult right now. Let's not get into the politics and bore the living daylights out of you. But the main opposition is refusing to help. So Papandreou's party is going to have to team up with three other marginal parties, including the communists, to get this done. And that process of cajoling and convincing and prodding starts tomorrow.
So there's been talk that he would just resign if he won, right? Which now that he's won, is it possible that he could step down and start from scratch?
Well, maybe. I mean, he said things during his speech tonight that suggests he'd be willing to resign, but there are no guarantees with this. He's an enormously unpopular and divisive figure, so his resignation could help. But, you know, this is Greece, and, you know, he may decide that this vote of confidence gives him a kind of twisted mandate to push on as Greece's leader. You know, that would be incredibly unpopular, very incendiary. It could kill the coalition and force possibly a general election.
And if you play that out, that takes at least weeks, right?
Yeah, maybe even months. And meanwhile, it's not just the parliament that's in disarray. You know, the Greek people are on the streets right now. They're complaining about the austerity program. So there's considerable social unrest. And that's only going to add to the uncertainty about Greece's fate and, by extension, the eurozone.
Yeah, so let's cut to the chase on the whole uncertainty thing. I mean, there has been so far in this crisis a certain certainty to the uncertainty, and now we really don't know what's going on. So play the markets out for me.
Right, well, the markets are going to be hanging themselves. I mean, if you know, they know that European leaders aren't going to do what it takes to save Greece. And this is obvious now that the country's political parties are in such disarray that they're incapable of saving themselves. So this lack of will to make hard decisions, it's been driving the markets to distraction for weeks, and which is why we can expect to see a lot more in the way of kind of wild swings and, you know, in the month, next month or so.
All right, so give me your gut then on the question you didn't really answer to begin with, which is the euro going to be saved? I mean, is there a way this doesn't work out?
I think the euro gets saved. I mean, I think that there's too much at stake here, and I think that the Greek parliamentarians know this. There's a lot of political jockeying back and forth. But in the end, I mean, this vote didn't even go down on party lines. One person crossed the aisle to join Papandreou's party. It's only one person, but it shows that people are willing to actually get this done. So I think it's a brave decision by the Greek parliament actually to get this done, and I think that they will push through.
And the markets have the weekend to think about. Patty Hirsch, our senior editor on the Greek No Confidence story tonight. Patty, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Prime Minister George Papandreou, by the way, born in St. Paul, Minnesota. You can look it up. Slow but steady. Decent, but nothing to write home about. That's pretty much been the jobs report mantra for a good long while now. Today's October numbers were more of the same. 80,000 jobs added all told, nicely spread out in healthcare, hotels and restaurants, temporary workers, all of which leads to a slight downtick in the unemployment rate to an even 9.0%. There is some relief it wasn't worse, too, given all that's happening in Athens and Washington and Cannes and who knows where else. But thing is, it's not like this is a job market that's going to get us back to where we need to be, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
So what's a really rockin' economy sound like?
This morning, when the Labor Department released the new report on job creation, analysts were expecting the numbers to be good, but they turned out to be twice as good as they'd predicted. Could it be The end of the jobless recovery?
Unfortunately, that's from Marketplace Past, October 2004. And the jobless recovery was over. We started getting 250,000-300,000 new jobs a month for the next couple years, which isn't remotely likely now, says economist John Canale at LPL Financial.
The jobs that were created during the last part of that recovery won't ever come back.
Canale says housing, which has time and again led the U.S. out of recession, is dead in the water and not reviving.
So there are an awful lot of construction workers, folks in the financial services industry. People with that skill set are no longer needed in the economy.
And economists can't point to any other industry robust enough to absorb 6 million chronically unemployed Americans.
This is really a disastrous situation.
Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research argues that we can get back to 300,000 jobs a month and 5% unemployment, but it'll take time.
You have to look for some additional source of stimulus, and obviously if the government were to do another round, doesn't seem likely, but if we're to get some part of President Obama's jobs plan, that would help.
Conservatives counter loosen regulations on private industry and cut government, but that's not likely to jumpstart job creation in the short term either. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Hey, don't look now, but the International Monetary Fund is hip again. 5 years ago, when the world economy was going gangbusters, it almost seemed like the IMF wasn't really needed anymore. But it's back. At the G20 meeting that wrapped up in the south of France today, the IMF said it would be more than happy to help out in Rome with the Italian problem. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
The IMF used to specialize in helping poor countries that were drowning in debt. Now the IMF is supervising Italy, one of the largest economies in the world. Ted Truman is an international economist with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says the IMF's new role in Italy is unprecedented.
And it's been a shock to the Europeans. You know, they felt they could wash their own laundry, and that has proved not to be true.
The IMF will be rummaging through Italy's dirty laundry, issuing quarterly reports on whether Rome is falling behind on its promised financial reforms, like raising the retirement age. The IMF will also be setting up some kind of EU emergency fund, but the details still have to be worked out. Some of the money would need to come from newly rich countries like China and Brazil. Will they contribute? Alexei Montserrat is an IMF analyst at the Atlantic Council.
I don't think that anybody going around with a tin cup hoping for people to drop some pennies into it is going to get a whole lot of serious interest unless there's a very clear business case that it makes sense.
There's just not enough confidence that Europe can handle this alone. Mark Weisbrot is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He says China is being extra cautious.
It doesn't make sense for them to be risking very much for Europe. On the other hand, they have $3 trillion of reserves. They could do something.
He says the IMF could give China the reassurance it needs. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders started down. They tried real hard but didn't quite make it back to even. We'll have the details when we always have the details. I know I keep saying this by way of setting up our regular Friday weekly wrap, but man, this has been a pretty interesting 5 days, I think. I'll spare you the list of particulars and get straight to it. The lucky winners from our pool of usual suspects this week are Felix Salmon from Reuters, also Lee Gallagher from Fortune magazine. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Is that all right? Usual suspects, you okay with that?
Of course.
All right. We love it.
So we'll go reverse chronologically, I think, Felix, and talk about the jobs report this morning. And here's what I want to know. How does one convince people that 9%, if not the new normal, is closer to where things are going to stay for a while than 4%, which is where it was in the recession on unemployment?
That's what it is. They don't even need convincing. The question is whether, I mean, politically, the big question is whether the electorate is going to blame Barack Obama for this extremely gruesome state of affairs. But there's no way that he's going to get 4 or 5% unemployment under his presidency, even if he does get reelected.
Yeah, no, I guess that wasn't really the question. The question was, how do you convince people that we're going to be closer to, say, 7 for the next 20 years than we were to 4?
Ah, the non-accelerating inflation, the basic rate of unemployment has gone up.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of debate about that. I think it probably has gone up a bit, and that's a strong case for improving the social safety net and you know, looking after this newly permanent class of unemployed people that we have in this country.
Yeah. So, Lee, on that permanently unemployed class of people, talk to me about mood. What is your sense of mood? Even though today's report was moderately upbeat, what do you think?
Well, yeah, the report today wasn't bad. There were revisions upward, which is good. But the Fed a couple days ago revised growth downward. And that's really where the mood strikes, because that, you know, basically we're kind of settling in and preparing for, as you said, kind of sustained a higher base level. I think the Fed was predicting by 2014 we're going to be looking at somewhere between roughly 7% and 8%. And that's 2014. So I think the mood is going to quickly shift to, OK, let's buckle down for, you know, prepare for a long, cold economic winter for the foreseeable future, which is not a good mood to be in. No.
And remember that the Fed's job is to create full employment. And so the Fed is failing at its job and will be failing at its job for years to come.
And maybe the reason why they're not doing more with policy, not injecting more into the system, is because they can't right now. They just think it's not going to do anything. The problems are more longer term.
Right. They're kind of maxed out. Speaking of longer term problems, let's go to Europe for a second. Forget Papandreou and confidence votes and all this stuff. Felix, who are you more worried about, Greece or Italy?
They're both very worrying.
Come on, Italy.
Okay. Because if Italy goes, then the entire global economy goes into freefall. Italy is Lehman to the power 10. Greece is survivable. The euro might not survive as we know it, but at least the global economy could somehow muddle through. Italy, there's no way we could survive that.
Lee, same question.
Well, this is good because I'll take the other side. I'm much more worried about Greece because Greece is now. Greece is imminent. Greece is what has a chokehold on the global economy right now. And if there's a chance it could get contained, and that, you know, not only Italy, but Portugal and all the other, you know, countries will not, it won't spill over. But once it does, it's not just going to be Italy that we have to worry about. Yeah. It's going to be everything.
Do you really believe, though, that it can be contained, Lee?
Look, I think there is something, you know, there's a school of thought that a default can be very, you know, methodically executed. But the more this kind of herky-jerky narrative plays out, the more likely a messy default is going to happen.
This is Greece. This is not the most elegant and professional government in the world. You know, given the opportunity to do something chaotically, that's normally what happens.
But that's when the ECB can step in and do what it's not doing.
This is good. So I can just step out of this whole interview and you guys can just talk to each other. But sadly, we got to go. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Felix Salmon from Reuters. Thanks, you guys. Have yourselves a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
Cheers.
Bye. Shares of Bank of America tumbled today. Shareholders weren't happy about its plan to issue new stock to bump up capital reserves. And a lot of account holders aren't happy with B of A either, which is in part why tomorrow has been proclaimed Bank Transfer Day. It was so designated by a Bank of America customer here in Los Angeles, angry about the bank's infamous and, now it should be said, rescinded $5 a month debit card fee. The idea behind Bank Transfer Day is for people to abandon big banks for smaller, more local institutions. And partly as a result, credit unions, those sleepy not-for-profit cooperatives, are flush with $4.5 billion in new deposits. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has more now on the money migration.
The debit card fee Bank of America and other big banks rolled out ignited an uproar.
The $5 debit card use fee was sort of my last straw.
33-year-old Melissa Wilson is a Bank of America customer. Well, she was. The debit card fee made her so angry, she left B of A. And even when the bank nixed the fee, she didn't look back.
It's just too little too late. The fact that they even tried to do it was enough for me.
Between debit fees and Occupy Wall Street, community banks and credit unions smell opportunity.
We'll let the big banks take care of Wall Street. We'll be right here, taking care of Main Street. Own your money. Join a credit union.
Credit unions are extending hours and creating switch kits, step-by-step guides to leaving your bank. Bill Cheney is president of the Credit Union National Association.
We've heard from credit unions from all across the country that they've seen an increase in business. We've heard anywhere from double their normal new account volume to five times as much.
Cheney's organization reports that since Bank of America unveiled its debit card fee, 650,000 people have joined credit unions. That's more new accounts in 6 weeks than credit unions registered all of last year.
Among my group of friends, people are leaving in droves and joining credit unions.
That's 29-year-old Taylor Overstreet from Austin, Texas. This week, she moved her money from Chase Bank to a local credit union. She wasn't unhappy with Chase, but she wanted to join the movement against big banks.
Friends on Facebook and Twitter talking about switching over. I had visited the Occupy Austin website, and I think it was Bank Action Day. So I guess you could say it was effective marketing.
The recent defections to credit unions aren't enough to impact the big guys right now, says analyst Ron Shevlin with the iTake Group. Those banks have millions of accounts, and many of the people leaving are young and not the most lucrative customers. Still, Shevlin says the big banks should be worried.
The impact of bank transfer day shouldn't be thought of in a single day perspective. The bigger impact is 10 to 15 years out.
When those former customers are in their earning prime and banking elsewhere. Not that switching is trouble-free. When she moved her money out of Bank of America, Melissa Wilson forgot to cancel the automatic transfer she'd set up between her checking and savings accounts.
It charged me an overdraft fee for trying to transfer money that wasn't there from one account to another.
Wilson has paid more than $500 in fees to Bank of America this year and says she didn't have the energy to fight the last one. So she surrendered another $10. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, how not to handle the business of social media.
You don't walk in with your megaphone blasting your marketing message and, you know, buy my stuff.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the Dow Industrials fell 61 points this Friday, about a half percent, ended at 11,983. The NASDAQ erased 11 points, 0.4%, 2686 at the bell. The S&P 500 cleared away 7 points, 0.6%, 1253 is the number you're looking for. So ends a lousy week, though. Since Monday, the Dow unpacked 2%, the NASDAQ close behind with a loss of 1.9%. The S&P 500 peeled away 2.5%. Bank of America unbanked 6%. Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Morgan Stanley each fell more than 1%. Goldman Sachs down nearly 2.5% at the close today. Groupon rocketed up 30% in its trading debut. Today, at least, investors apparently thought its business model is worth something. So maybe now we can stop talking about the Groupon IPO. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, in support of Small Business Saturday and small businesses every day of the week. Learn more at ConstantContact.com/Saturday. By Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In New York, the Federal Reserve will release the Consumer Report for September. In Washington, the Census Bureau will release new research on how to measure poverty in America. And Monday marks the first day of National Animal Shelter Appreciation Week. It was started in 1996 by the Humane Society of the United States. I'm Desiree Pena.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The White House came right out yesterday and said something it's really only hinted at before. A guy named Robert Bryant, he's the head of U.S. counterintelligence, said the Russians and the Chinese are using cyber attacks to steal American technology and then use it for their own economic gain. And cybercrime is an equal opportunity offender, as you know. Earlier this year, a European criminal group was arrested for draining about $72 billion from personal bank accounts using an especially malicious bit of software called the Configure Worm. Mark Bowden writes about it in his new book, Worm, it's called, The First Digital World War. Mark, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Kai.
Tell me what this worm does, the Conficker worm.
What it does mostly is infect computers, connect them to one another, and set them up so that they can receive orders from a remote controller.
Sounds very Armageddon-like, I got to tell you.
Well, it can be. I mean, if you can link together a million, or in this case, 10 to 12 million computers, you have a remarkably powerful, essentially a supercomputer at your bidding. And you could use it for all manner of things, including launching an attack that could literally crash the internet itself.
You know, as I hear you say Conficker, and I've been mispronouncing it the whole time, who names these things?
Well, this one was named by a group of engineers at Microsoft. And one of the first things that this very cunning little piece of software did when it invaded a computer was attempt to contact a well-known spam distributor online called TrafficConverter.biz. So they were fooling around with the syllables of TrafficConverter.biz, and they came up with Conficker, which was, well, Ficker is German for the sexual act, and their
nice.
Feelings about the worm were that it was a real mother ficker.
Right, right. So this book will sell because it has your name on it and it's getting lots of press and all that. But it seems to me that there's a disconnect between the message you deliver in this book, which is that these things can be really, really destructive and we have to pay attention, and the fact that most people just want their computers to work, man. We don't care what goes on in the guts.
Well, I think that's fair. I would hope that anyone who reads the book would better understand why botnets like the Conficker botnet pose a very serious threat. Not so much to the individual computer user, although it does that too, but primarily to society at large. Nowadays, if you have the knowledge and a computer and you're connected or control something like the Conficker botnet, you could wreak terrific havoc on modern society all by your lonesome.
Not to get all Machiavellian here, but one has to assume, perhaps even hope, that the Department of Defense and the White House and the administration have their own botnet army ready to go, right?
Well, I would assume that's the case. You know, the most famous instance of a targeted piece of malware in the last few years was Stuxnet, which,
right,
of course,
right,
took out the uranium enrichment activities in Iran. You know, I think cyber warfare is very much a part of the modern world now. And particularly in the last few years, I do think the federal government has gotten a lot more attuned to the need to both defend our networks in this country, although I don't think they're capable of doing it just yet, but also to develop the ability to use these things as weapons ourselves.
Mark Bowden's latest book is called Worm, The First Digital World War. Mark, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai. Thank you.
Social networking. That's all you ever hear anymore. And in our context, what it can do for business and you. And yeah, I tweet and sometimes I blog and maybe a couple more people listen to the program because of it. But there are days when I wonder what the point is. Handily, there's a conference in Los Angeles this week called the Blog World. And we sent Marketplace's Adrian Hill to explore what the costs and benefits of social media really are.
This is the story of two very different companies trying to figure out their social media strategies. One is launching a new vodka called Euphoric, spelled with the letter U and the number 4 and a K.
It's a premium vodka. It's grape-based. So it comes from wine grapes. It's not like your traditional vodkas that come from starch.
That's the company's marketing consultant, John Burke. The other company sells something perhaps less sexy and more necessary than high-end vodka. Contact lenses.
In the United States, there's four major players that dominate 98% of the market. We are a part of the 2% other.
That's Courtney McMillan, a VP at the contact company Polyview.
We have a neglected Facebook page, and that's basically about it.
McMillan is here to figure out what kind of social media strategy her office of four people can pull off. Burke, from the vodka company, is looking to develop a social media strategy that'll have people ordering Euphoric right along with Grey Goose and Belvedere. They're both looking for easy and fast ways to reach those bazillions of people on blogs and Facebook and Twitter. So it's off to conference land, a world of projected presentations, scripted jokes, stale coffee, and sometimes real nuggets of information. Jason Falls is the CEO of Social Media Explorer. He says you've got to think of social media like a cocktail party.
You don't walk in with your megaphone blasting your marketing message and, you know, buy my stuff.
Because then no one would like you. They will unfriend you. They will unfollow you. Instead,
You listen to the conversations and find the ones that make sense to you, and you start to introduce yourself and network and grow relationships over time.
Friends don't come easy. If you're a company, the value of social media is about getting people to trust you or think you're cool. And when those people need something, to think of buying it from you because they trust you or think you're cool. That, it turns out, can take a lot of time. And even though a lot of the tools of social media, like Facebook and Twitter and Blogger, are free,
social media is by no means free. It is not inexpensive.
Jay Baer runs a social media consultancy firm.
It's just different expensive. You are trading advertising dollars or production dollars for labor dollars. It is extraordinarily time intensive to do this well.
Ooh, so not cheap, not easy, not fast. At the end of the day, I check in to see how McMillan and Burke are faring.
It is pretty overwhelming.
But also intriguing. McMillan thinks her office might be able to create a blog that brings new eyeballs to her company website. Burke also has a head full of ideas. But here's the thing.
At the core of it, it's not really different from just traditional marketing. It's really making sure that you listen to your customer, that you know your customer, that you do your research, that you make your messaging be real and authentic, and you try to make that connection.
And really, just be that super likable guy or gal at the cocktail party. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted email. Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, the hearing of which will do nothing to ease the average person's discomfort with how Wall Street operates. Remember the other day we told you how federal regulators think MF Global, the now defunct brokerage house, had commingled customers' money with company money, mostly because investigators couldn't find hundreds of millions of dollars in customers' money? Well, now MF Global said it thinks it knows where the money is. It's in an account at J.P. Morgan, all $659 million of it. J.P. Morgan says, nuh-uh. We don't have it. We don't know where it is. You chuckle only so you don't cry. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Friday. Today, the Dow fell 61 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ erased 11 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 cleared away 7 points, 0.6 of 1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager of the Marketplace Enterprise. Coming up this weekend on our personal financial Marketplace Money, if you're out there looking for a job, just one word for you, perseverance.
If someone has enough initiative to drive and hand deliver a resume to every single veterinarian in the Willamette Valley, this person must really want a job.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll meet you back here on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.